This is Line One, your health connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon, and welcome once again to Line One, your health connection. And today I'm going to just get right into this program. We're going to be talking about unplanned pregnancy, and particularly related to teens, but all age groups should be interested in listening to the program. My guest today by telephone is Sarah Brown. She's the Chief Executive Officer of the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unintended Pregnancy. And in the studio with me here in Anchorage is Enzina Morari. She's the Educational Manager at Planned Parenthood of the Great Northwest. Welcome to each of you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you, Thad.
One of the underlying tenets I do this program is to do my best to try to get people thinking about what we know and what we believe, and continuing reevaluating what we believe based on what we have learned, because what we learned as a child may not even be reliable anymore. And so a good place for me to start, and I hope our listeners, is to just maybe discuss some of the myths and misconceptions regarding teen pregnancy and unplanned pregnancies. And Sarah, I'll ask you to start with that and try to give us as much information about some of the pertinent points that we can. And then, Enzina, if you want to chime in with some thoughts, we'd appreciate it.
Sure.
Well, thank you for having me so much, Thad. It's really a pleasure. And I'm glad we have a good chunk of time, too. I don't know if this is a myth or a fact, but I'm constantly struck by the reality that very few people know how much young adults struggle with pregnancy and unwanted pregnancy and so forth, that it's not just teens. The teen pregnancy problem in Alaska and in the nation is serious, but their older brothers and sisters have a lot of trouble in this area too. Just for example, half of pregnancies in the U.S., women say, were unplanned, unintended at the time they became pregnant. Half. Most of those women are single, but not all of them. And so even though I celebrate and am delighted we're going to be talking quite a bit about teens, it's always important to remember that it is not just teens in this country who are having trouble with sex, love, and relationships. It's really, in a way, all of us. And let me just give you one other number to drive this point home. I occasionally, in a setting, will ask a group, what proportion or what percent of abortions in this country do you think are to teens? And people will say 50, 60. I even had a woman one time say over 70%. The correct answer is 17%, which I think is another way of shining a light on the fact that teens certainly struggle with these issues, but they're not the only ones. So I appreciate your introductory comment that we're going to be talking about really all of us, not just youngsters.
And hence the title of your organization is to make sure that we're aware that it is not just a teen, but it's a women's problem.
That's right. You know, and if I were to go to just some party, you know, just some neighborhood party, but maybe with people I didn't know or something, and people would say, well, what do you do? Mm-hmm. If I say, well, you know, I work on preventing teenage pregnancy, everybody says, oh, that's great, that's wonderful, that's a big problem. But if I say I'm working on preventing unintended or unplanned pregnancy in general, people just sort of raise an eyebrow. They kind of don't know, they don't resonate to that, because we only talk about teens. And there's some reason for that, incidentally. The consequences are particularly hard, particularly the children of teen mothers. But a lot of the solutions, a lot of the underlying problems, a lot of the explanations pertain not just to teens, but to young adults as well.
So the consequences may be worse for teens, but the underlying reasons for an unintended pregnancy remain pretty much the same, is what I heard you say.
Well, yes, I think that's well said. The consequences are particularly severe for teens, particularly, again, the children born to teen mothers. But there are consequences throughout, particularly for young women who experience an unintended pregnancy when they're single. You know, I think we all kind of feel if people are married, you know, it's one of the things that kind of happens in marriage is having children. And whether it was planned or unplanned, you know, people will say, well, my third child was unplanned and so forth. And we all understand that. But when it happens to single women, whether they're teenagers or young adults, that's where we really see the greater level of risk. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I think something that's important to address is that it is highly a women's issue, but it is also a male's issue
sure.
as well.
Yeah, I realized sure. I was in deep yeah. trouble when I said that.
And I think that's something that we need to focus on, especially with education, right. is not just educating women on how to prevent their pregnancies, but educating men on how to prevent pregnancies as well, because it's a dual issue.
Mm-hmm. And just a sort of a friendly comment on what was just said. I'm finding increasingly that I talk with people not so much about preventing pregnancy, although it's even in the title of my organization, but more about timing of pregnancy. Because the vast majority of men and women, teenage girls, teenage boys, do want children. If you do public polling, it's well over 90-95%. So the question that all of us are struggling with, I mean, you know, people like Enzina who work on the front lines or, you know, a national group like mine, we're trying to help people often delay childbearing a little bit until they're grown up or till they're finished school or till they have a steady income or till they're in a stable relationship, which is what children need. So it's really not, you know, we sometimes sound like we're just, you know, don't want anybody to get pregnant ever. And in fact, the people who work in this field, I find the vast majority of them are deeply oriented to children and families. And the question is just sort of when, with whom, under what circumstances. It's not never get pregnant.
I want to keep stressing or talking about the educational idea, and perhaps we can get to that when we talk about what do we know about what works. But I want to not leave the myth misconception area. So, Enzina, do you have a thing that comes to your mind or one or
sure.
two as well? When
sure.
I ask
and
that?
What I think about when I hear the myths and misconceptions is not necessarily what we as a society are misinformed about teen pregnancy, but with what I do in education, I'm just astounded by, over the years, how many of the myths are still out there. I work with kids from sixth grade all the way up through college, and it doesn't matter how old they are or what their life experiences are. Oftentimes, people don't know how their body works. They don't know how their reproductive organs work. Women are on birth control, and they don't know how birth control works. I've talked to teens who think you just take birth control when you're going to have sex,
right.
and so they're not
yep.
taking it
right.
accurately. And that you know, oftentimes, Sarah mentioned the number of pregnancies that are unwanted and those that end in abortion. And oftentimes, we have women reporting that they are using birth control when they're having an unintended pregnancy. They're just not using it accurately sure. or they're just not informed on it. And so what it shows us is that our education is failing our young people. And either they're getting misinformation from their peers or from the media or from the internet, but they're just not getting the accurate information. And so a lot of times what I end up doing is just answering the myths and resolving mm-hmm. the myths for them because mm-hmm. they just aren't aware.
And Sarah, I guess I'm anticipating you would agree that even adult women are also have mm-hmm. misconceptions about their options in preventing pregnancies, unintended pregnancies.
That's exactly right. You know, I think if some 15-year-old or 16-year-old is confused or doesn't know basic facts, I think, you know, we sort of say, gee, we understand that. We wish they knew more, and we need to provide education and support so they know more. But I think we have failed to understand that there are a whole lot of people who are no longer teenagers who don't know much either.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
We're going to be releasing some information in another few months, a survey of single young adults 18 to 30.
Mm-hmm.
And my jaw just drops when I read some of these responses. But then I think about it. Let's say you're, I don't know, 25. You may have had no sex education, or maybe mm-hmm. you had it when you were, I don't know, 8th grade, 10th grade. Well, you could be, you know, 6, 7, 8 years older now.
Right.
Right. And I don't remember a whole lot of what I learned in high school, you know.
Yeah.
And it's again, we have a very large problem in this country of not only people not knowing the basics, as Indina just said, you know, how bodies work,
mm-hmm.
but they also, because they don't know the truth, they also harbor a lot of fears. I've been in this field now for about 35 years, and I think that the level of fear of modern birth control is higher than it's been probably ever. Because when you don't have information or good information, then any story, any rumor on the internet, anything your girlfriend says or some rumor you heard and whatever, that becomes true because there's no counter story. So we have young women saying all the time, you know, this causes cancer, this causes death, this, you know, this will make my boyfriend sterile. This, it's just on and on and on. And in fact, there is no birth control method that is anywhere near as risky, for example, as becoming pregnant,
mm-hmm.
just flat out,
right.
which is what, you know, we're trying to postpone.
Right.
But there's a high level not only of misinformation but flat out fear.
Mm-hmm. One of the as a physician who enjoys education, thinks he tries hard at it. I know I have my own mistakes, but one of the things I've tried to promote in talking to people and on this program is when we start talking about risks of things like you all are doing every day, I always try to bring up the fact we've got to remember what's the risk of not doing something
mm-hmm.
as
That's
well.
Right.
And this idea that pregnancy is more dangerous than everything else is a very, very, very important message for teenage girls to hear, for sure.
Well, and it's true for older women as well. And again, mm-hmm. I'm not suggesting a fear message, mm-hmm. but it just, if someone says, you know, this thing, whatever it is, whether it's an over-the-counter drug, you know, a cold medicine, a cheeseburger, mm-hmm. anything, does it have risks? It's mm-hmm. as compared to what? You know, there's nothing we put in our body that doesn't have an effect. And so I just think this conversation about birth control for a lot of young men and women, teenagers and young adults, has become sort of separate from any grasp of reality.
Okay. Let me take just a second. I want to remind our listeners, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Today we're talking about preventing unplanned pregnancies at all ages in women, maybe a little bit of emphasis on the teens. And you're welcome to give us a call. Our local phone number is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and you can also email me at lineone, lineone, all one word, at kska.org. And you can do that between now and shortly before 3 o'clock Anchorage time, and we'll be glad to try to take your call or answer your email. Any other myths before we go to my most important reason for being here is I want to know what the science is, what's the evidence on what works and what doesn't work in trying to help. So I'll give you guys one more chance on the myths, and then we're going to move on to that. Any other comments?
I think that a large myth, and this is a tough one, but that teens don't involve their parents on their pregnancy decisions. And we see this being contradicted a lot. What we know is that the large part of younger teens do involve their parents in their pregnancy decisions. They bring their parents into the clinic with them. They communicate with their parents about that. And I think that's something important to address, especially for some of the political stuff that's going on right now. There's a misconception that teens aren't involving their parents. And we see that they are.
Mm-hmm. I guess that surprises me,
Pat,
a little bit.
I have one more myth for you.
Oh, okay.
Is this my last chance?
Yeah. we're getting close. But no, I love talking about myths and misconceptions. Go ahead.
But I didn't mean to interrupt you if you were following up.
We'll come back to your myth. I promise we won't forget you. I guess I was a little surprised on that. I don't know what the numbers are specifically and where it comes from. Although, you know, as a pediatrician, I don't know. Maybe I can believe that. I'd have to think about mm-hmm. that one a little bit. But off the cuff, I was going to be a little surprised.
And when I say that, I mean their pregnancy choices. So if they did experience a pregnancy mm-hmm. and were going into a clinic to decide what the option they were going to choose was, oftentimes more out of less, they involve their parents in that decision.
Okay. Yeah, I guess I can buy into that. That makes
maybe
sense.
Not up
I mean,
to that point.
And that's not what I'm trying to do is get my intuition.
Yeah.
I want to know, how do we know that kind of stuff? All right.
Yeah.
Sarah, your myth.
Well, I think the one I would offer is that if you talk with young people directly and clearly about sex and birth control and so forth, that that's going to cause them to go out and experiment with sex and, you know, do all that stuff.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, I have three kids. I understand how parents are concerned about that. I don't think that's irrational. I think, you know, if you talk to somebody about a whole bunch of stuff, isn't that going to make them, you know, do it?
Mm-hmm.
The good news here is that there's been well over 15 years of research on the effect of various classroom programs on sexual behavior. And very well done. We can talk more about this during the hour if you wish. But the bottom line is that good, candid discussion about the risks of pregnancy and sexually transmitted diseases, you know, the reality, the facts, how to prevent them, what the consequences are, sort of what's going on in the state, you know, the numbers, are rates going up or down, all that stuff leads, in fact, to a later age of first sex and to better use of protection. So if people are concerned about, do we have programs that will help young people delay sex, the answer is, you bet. We've got quite a few of them. They tend to be the ones that are very complete in the material they cover. They're directive, they're clear, they have a point of view, the teachers are well-trained, and a variety of other characteristics. But again, the good news is that we know that good education on these topics, in fact, gets us where we want to go, which is less sex, later sex among teens, especially young teens. And for those teens who do become sexually active, and the vast majority do by the time they turn 20, they are better at using protection.
And, Sarah, I'd like to add to that some people are unaware of the types of educational programs that are provided for sex education, and there are some that are strictly abstinence only. There are some that are abstinence plus, and some that are fully comprehensive, which is the ones I think you were referring to. And what we see and what the studies show is that the comprehensive approaches are the ones that delay onset.
You guys are sneaking into the evidence here. Hang on about what works. Let's.
Okay.
I might have a little bit. I have one little bit of work I got to do. I want to get this off the air and over with, and then we'll just press on some more. I wanted everybody to know you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on KSK. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
The recorded rebroadcast of today's Line 1 Your Health Connection with Dr. Thad Woodard will repeat tonight at 8, and an archived copy will be available online at kska.org following today's live broadcast. KSKA is supported by listeners like you and Providence Alaska Medical Center. Stroke is an emergency. Providence Alaska Medical Center is committed to increasing awareness of the symptoms of a stroke. If you or anyone you know has sudden weakness on one side of your body, sudden confusion, trouble speaking or understanding, sudden trouble seeing, walking or loss of balance, or sudden severe headache without cause, call 911 and get to the hospital within 1 hour. Information at providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence Alaska Medical Center. This is KSKA Anchorage.
This is Line 1, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're talking about unintended pregnancies, both in teens and older women. If you've got any questions or comments about what you're hearing today, or you want to share some experiences with us, let me give you two phone numbers and an email to contact us during the next 45 minutes or so. Local number 550-8433. Our outside number, our toll-free number, that is 1-888-353-5752. And you can email me directly at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, at kska.org. Okay, so let's now ask the question I want. How do we know what works, what does work, what's the evidence for what works? And Sarah, let me start with you.
Well, We have to kind of get real dorky here for just a second. Is that okay?
I am the king of the dorks, so go for it.
All right. Well, the key thing in trying to understand what works is whether you set up a really good research study. And over the last, you know, several decades, social scientists have worked very hard to figure out how to know whether an intervention makes a difference. And this has nothing to do with the word sex education. It could be highway safety, nutrition, a new marketing plan in a corporation, anything. How do we know if we start doing something? How do we know if it makes a difference? And in this field of social science, we have learned a lot over the last number of years about how to do this, how to set up a good study. And it's the rules are the same, whether it's for gardening or, you know, atmospherics or, you know, airplane safety. And it has to do with establishing, you know, the right number of people who you're going to study, how the intervention, in this case sex ed or these programs that we want to know if they work, who gets them and who doesn't, how we track their progress over time and blah, blah, blah. And the key thing I always urge people to do is to keep their eye on the best science, the best design studies. Because, you know, you can do a sort of junkie study. You know, you get a bunch of people, sit them in your living room, ask them something or whatever it is, and you can get almost any result you want. But we have learned over years how to do these studies, and the gold standard, the one that we're always looking for, is called a randomized trial, which means people are assigned at random as to whether they get sort of business as usual or they get the new thing we're testing, whatever it is. And so a group like ours and other groups as well, when someone says, well, what works, what we say to ourselves is, let's go look for the best quality research we can find, with the best design, the right numbers, the right tests, the right statistics, and let's get ones that are well done, and then we'll look at the results, what they found. And so fortunately, in this field of preventing teen pregnancy in particular, we now have a good set, about 20-ish studies that have been done really well. They've been well set up, done by very, very good researchers. And so we look at their results, and when we see good news, as we do in these 20-ish, we say, goodness sakes, based on the best science we have, we actually do now have some programs that do one of three things. They delay first sex, they increase contraceptive use for the people having sex, and or they actually reduce teen pregnancy. And the reason we don't always just look for teen pregnancy as the one result is that, believe it or not, teen pregnancy is actually a rather rare occurrence in a school or whatever. And you'd have to have a very large sample, we call it, you know, the number of people in the study, to see statistically significant differences in pregnancy rates. I told you this was going to get really boring, but I'll stop. It's just that when we use really good science, the good news is that we now have a list of several programs, many school-based, but not all, that actually do seem to reduce teen pregnancy or the things that lead to it, which is early sex and unprotected sex.
Well, as one dork to another, I want to tell you how much I appreciate your thoughtfulness on this topic. It's gotten to the point where everybody who sees that there was a scientific study done assumes that that scientific study was done well, and the example is in a full-page ad in today's Anchorage Daily News talking about some questionable treatments for arthritis, which is a common one, and it says there's clinical studies. And what you're saying and what I think I want everybody to hear is not all studies are the same, and it is very important now that we take the lessons of science and look at them very, very carefully and be sure what we're looking at and that we're good studies. So that's rewarding for me to hear that an organization such as yours is done that kind of due diligence on looking at the evidence for these things.
Well, I really appreciate it. It doesn't make us popular because we look really, really dull. Not are we, you know, not only are we from Washington, but we're boring, right?
Well, but you're going to you're promoting things that, as best we know, doesn't mean it's going to be the same in the future. But right now, it's where we ought to be putting our efforts and our money, not on things that are unproven and or have very poor evidence of suggesting that.
I really think that's right, especially. When we're using taxpayer dollars. And again, it doesn't matter what the issue is. Whatever, it could be highway safety.
Mm-hmm.
We only have a certain amount of money to spend on any of these important social problems we face. Job training. What programs are we going to use? And I think as a taxpayer, my view is I want the very best research to inform that decision. Now, you know, you may still want to do a few other things. You know, not everything depends just on science. But when you don't, when there's a serious problem and you have a few programs you can choose from to fund, I always will urge people to look for the best research and then start there. Look at the ones that actually make a difference using the current techniques for doing this kind of work.
And Zena, let me ask you your thoughts on this topic.
I agree with you, Sarah, and I just want to bring up, I don't know if these are any of your 20 studies, but one study that made a rather large stink is the Mathematica study that came out.
Yes.
And is it 2007 or 2008? I think it's 2008.
I think it was probably 2007.
And this was a study that was sponsored by the United States government to study the effectiveness of abstinence-only programs. The United taxpayers, United States, spends about $1.5 billion on these abstinence-only programs. And what the study found was that the abstinence-only approach doesn't delay sexual intercourse. It doesn't change the number of partners that a teen might have if they were in this abstinence-only program or if they were mm-hmm. not in this abstinence-only program. And what it also showed was that teens who went through these programs were less likely to know that condoms would provide protection against STDs or would provide protection against HIV or AIDS, and let alone the other types of birth control methods that are out there. So what we know is that abstinence-only methods don't work in delaying first onset of intercourse, of preventing pregnancy or preventing STDs,
mm-hmm.
And therefore not helping to prevent against pregnancy or birth. So we know that is one of those big studies that shows us that this type of education that we've been putting billions of dollars in isn't effective.
Mm-hmm.
There are also several studies that reflect the decreased pregnancy rates in teens to an improved use of contraceptives and also a delay in intercourse, which can be attributed to a more comprehensive approach.
Right. My first thought was that makes sense in the sense if you're only teaching one
right.
kind of way to prevent pregnancy, then you are not talking about other ways.
Mm-hmm.
And the more educated,
mm-hmm.
if you go and buy into the idea that the more
right.
you know, the better,
right.
then that makes kind of sense.
It does. And, you know, something that I think is going back to the myths and misconceptions is if you teach comprehensive sex ed, you're not teaching abstinence,
uh-huh.
which is not true. Abstinence is a big part of
right.
that comprehensive
right.
approach, and it's always the best method. It's the best strategy to prevent pregnancy and to prevent STDs.
Mm-hmm.
But what we know about teen sexual activity, and we could get to this later,
mm-hmm.
is that teens are having sex.
Right.
And if they are having sex, we need as a society and a culture to support them in gaining knowledge and tools to be healthy about what they're doing and to make healthier choices. And those comprehensive sex education programs not only give teens those tools about how to use birth control, what kind of birth control methods are available, how condoms are used, but also work to delay sexual intercourse.
Couple of comments. The study, this Mathematica study we're discussing, is the only study that used a randomized design to tease out the effects of four particular abstinence-only programs. And it is absolutely the case, as Zena said, that those four particular abstinence programs were not found to have an effect. But I also want to add one other thing, and I think, you know, to sort of round out the discussion. We also know from public opinion polling that the vast majority of Americans really prefer that their teens not have sex during adolescence. That is a very, very widely shared value. And I think that the idea of working hard to find programs that encourage young people to delay sex remains a very, very good idea. Now, as Anzina pointed out, some of the more comprehensive programs actually do that. So, you know, you sort of get both the protection message as well as the delay message. But in questioning the results of these abstinence programs, the four that were studied, that doesn't mean to suggest in any way that there's any disrespect to the idea of encourage or the value of encouraging young people to delay sex. I mean, I have never met a parent, I'm sure Anzina would agree with me,
I've
never met a parent that thinks it's just fine if they're 15-year-olds having sex. The issue is that we still have a lot to learn about how to get young people to delay. These programs that we're talking about that work, the so-called work, you know, they don't eliminate the problem. They make a contribution. They may reduce risk factors by 20 or 30%. But I know, or at least I hope later in the program, we're going to talk about other issues like parents, internet, media, and so forth. I think it is unfortunate, or unwise, rather, to expect a school-based program to really take care of these very complex issues like sex, pregnancy, sexually transmitted diseases, and so forth. I mean, if you think about the school day and sort of what goes on in schools, especially with No Child Left Behind legislation, the principal pressure on these schools now is to achieve academic standards. Nationwide, school people tell me that they're losing class hours for health education, where this material often occurs. They're losing physical education. They're losing arts, music, all sorts of things. And, you know, what that means is that it's the responsibility of an entire community to fill in these gaps and to provide education and support and services and opportunities, everything from good health education to good physical education. They're closely related, in fact. So we should keep talking about programs. I love doing it, but programs alone are not going to make the U.S. have a very low teen pregnancy rate. We have the highest in the developed world right now, even with recent progress. We need a full court press. We can't just leave it up to, you know, some poor teacher who has a few hours, you know, maybe a couple times a week, sometimes only in one grade. You know, very few school districts have comprehensive, good health education, including sex education, that goes from kindergarten to senior year. That's a luxury that many schools now say they simply can't afford. So you get a few hours of this in eighth grade and several hours of that in 11th grade or so forth. I'm in favor of it. I think it's a good idea. And there are some curriculums we've been discussing that help. But it is naive for us to think that if we can get these education programs in the schools, it'll eliminate the problem. It will help, absolutely, but it's not that simple.
For those who are listening who would like to get a little bit more information on this, on our website at ksk.org/line1, there is a link to the nationalcampaign.org, which has a downloadable bit of information about what we know about the programs that have worked. Sarah, before I move on, and I want to get into this issue about the media and parents and so forth, as you've alluded to, but the three issues that I heard you talk about, I'm a little confused on one, is that we know work. One is if we can delay the age of the first experience of sex, that helps. That makes
right.
sense. If we increase and somehow work towards programs that work towards increased use of contraception for those who are having sex, that helps. And then the
right.
third one I wrote down was if we decrease teen pregnancy.
Well,
so,
I was just referring to what researchers measure. So you're doing a program, and it's relatively easy to measure, did this program delay first sex? And it's relatively easy to measure contraceptive use, I mean, relatively speaking.
Right.
But in order to say that an intervention actually reduced teen pregnancy, you have to have a very large sample of young people.
Right.
And many researchers are working with, you know, 75 people in each group or I don't know, sometimes less, sometimes more. And it's just a sample size issue. So most of us have agreed that if we can affect either or both of those first two measures, okay, if those are going in the right direction, we can make an assumption mm-hmm. that we're going to reduce the teen pregnancy rate. But the wonderful, there are a number of studies that actually have had enough young people in it that they can show a reduction in a pregnancy rate. And that's, of course, just always very exciting.
All right. So let me ask the question then, what do we know about the influence of parents have on delaying the first experience with sex and preventing a teen pregnancy? And I'm going to refer to something I just happened to read this morning, and this was a Reuters report that is entitled, "Many Parents Lack Confidence in Changing Adolescent Behaviors." And it's dealing basically with trying to see how parents feel about helping children reduce their risk of childhood obesity by not sitting in front of a TV and watching what you eat. But it implies that if parents have a lack of confidence talking about that, mm-hmm. well, they probably are not very comfortable talking about sex.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we hear that all the time. And we hear it around the world, incidentally. It's very interesting. A lot of parents in the U.S. will say two things. I know I should be talking with my children and teenagers more about sex, love, and relationships. I know that, but I don't know how to get started, and I don't know what to say. So we hear that, what you're referring to, sort of a lack of confidence. And I think part of it has to do with two things. I think parents worry that they don't know everything. They go, oh, my goodness, there are all those diseases and birth control methods, and I'm always reading this stuff in the paper about, I don't know, oral sex or, you know, what's going on at the parties. And the whole thing just flips me out so much, I don't know what to say. And the second thing is that a lot of them are afraid that their children are going to ask them what they did as teenagers themselves. And a lot of parents will say that makes them very uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you get between, you know, sort of wondering about how this conversation's going to go. You know, am I going to get asked questions I'd rather not answer? And their general discomfort with the material, it's just easier to just sort of maybe hope the schools will take care of it. You know, maybe you'll have some, you know, wonderful person come in who helps out. But they really avoid it. And just one final comment. They'll often say, when should I have the talk with my son, daughter? When, of course, we know it's not a talk, it's an 18-year conversation. It's all the little bits of daily interaction. It's kids watching what their parents do, not just what they say. It's all the little snips, you know, of what we saw on TV and how do we feel about that and what about this and what about that, what went on in school today, what that movie, you know, all that stuff. That's what it is. It's not some awkward Tuesday night when someone sits down with a child who probably, you know, knows more than the parent. You know, by the time they sit down, you know, it's their 15 or 16. The teens tell us repeatedly that when their parents sit down and have the talk, the main thing they remember is how uncomfortable and awkward their parents were. They don't remember much of the information because their parents are sweating bullets,
mm-hmm.
and they're so sort of choked up that there's very little conversation.
Okay, so it would appear that is, for most teens, not the most reliable and most frequently used way to learn about sex.
Well, I think also to add to that, other than parents feeling uncomfortable or awkward or feeling like they don't have enough information or education on the topic, we have to think about their frame of reference and what their modeling, was like. Mm-hmm. Many people we talk to never had really good sex education from their parents.
Right.
And so they've never really learned how to relay this information to their kids or to their
mm-hmm.
teens.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that goes back to what Sarah was saying, that mm-hmm. that this isn't just an effort that we need to focus on with school-based curriculum,
mm-hmm.
that this has to be a community effort. It has to be a cultural effort and a cultural shift for us in the United States, because we haven't been openly talking about sex education
mm-hmm.
or teen
mm-hmm.
pregnancy or condom use or birth control. And I think a lot of times parents don't know how to have that conversation because they didn't have that conversation with their parents.
Good.
Yeah. I think that's right.
Good point.
I think that's right. And just to add something else to that, I think a lot of parents think that if they are open and discuss these issues with their kids, that somehow that automatically means they're giving a very liberal, permissive message.
Mm-hmm.
The people confuse candor and directness with permissiveness.
Well,
and in fact, it's possible to have a lot of conversations with young people where they're given very clear guidance about family expectations. It's not, you know, it doesn't mean that if you're candid and you're open, that you're then saying anything's fine.
Okay.
Well, I was just going to add that I think parents are also in a really tough situation. I've had lots of talks with parents who are feeling really conflicted and torn. Their 16-year-old teen daughter came to them and said they were thinking of becoming sexually active and wanted to get on birth control. And the parent to this teen didn't know what to do. They were happy that their teen came to them and included them in that decision, but felt like if they took that their teen to get birth control, then they would be approving of the behavior. So they wanted to help their teen, but they also didn't want to appear from other teens or other parents that they were approving of this behavior. So I think parents are in a really tough situation as well. And that's when we can offer parents more support and we can offer them more information and more tools on how to talk to their kids about sex and how to deal with their kids coming to them with being sexually active.
Let me bring up the media influence in this way of thinking about what's going on. What I'm hearing you say and what I'm beginning to think about in a way I hadn't thought about it before is, Sarah, you had said it's unrealistic for us to expect a teacher in a classroom to make significant changes in behaviors related to sex and kids. And, you know, the way you put it, you think about that makes sense. And both of you, and that implied to me that it has to be a bigger cultural change. And Encina already used the word, we have to change our culture. And then that brings me to how do we change culture? And the media is maybe doing that. And so that raises the question about what we often think of as the overemphasis on sex in the media, programs like 16 and Pregnant that's now on MTV and The Secret Life of an American Teenager. So my knee-jerk response is, well, these got to be bad, but maybe this is opening up a whole new bit of information, and maybe there is some good in all of this is driving this change towards more openness in sex in our culture. Comments?
Ooh.
Well,
go ahead, Sarah.
Well, here's something to ponder. The teen pregnancy and birth rates started going down in about 1990-91 and have gone down straight for 14 years.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time that media culture has become cruder.
Right.
So we can't draw a straight line or, you know, blame the media for our current ills. Right?
Do you see
the point I'm making?
Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
It doesn't rule it out, but there seems to be no correspondence to that.
Exactly.
In fact, there's an opposite.
Yes. So yeah, I think there's no question that the prevailing culture is cruder. I mean there's all these groups.
Yeah.
You know, people count how many mentions of, you know, sex or intercourse or whatever in every hour and so forth, and the numbers
and
are
probably and probably more exposure as well.
Oh, everything.
Yeah.
All of the
yeah.
above.
Yeah.
So what that means to me is a couple of things. We've actually done a lot of research on media influences on teens and young adults, and it goes like this. There is no question that media provides what I'd sort of call a social script. You know, what's in kids' heads? You know, what's normal? How do you handle situations? You know, you say, well, you know, on such and such a program, she did this or he did that. It becomes part of the overall environment, just teaching environment, like parents or schools or family. On the other hand, media can be a force for good, and I think the MTV 16 and Pregnant is a classic example. It's been the top-rated summer show in these summer entries, very hot real estate. I think the value of that show is that it shows how difficult teen pregnancy is. It really is a wake-up call. It's a reality show. It's in a young person's idiom. But it really can be a force for good. So I think the way to think about media is more that it's influential, and it can be either not so hot or possibly good. And again, all the more reason for education and for parents. I am amazed, just slack-jawed, at the amount of media that parents let their, even young teenagers, you know, kids in grammar school, consume. You know, they'll say, oh, yeah, we monitor media, but their kids will have internet connection up in their bedrooms. You know, parents fall asleep at 10. They're exhausted. And the kids can watch or download anything. And I think the reality is that raising children today requires real engagement of parents with the media of young people. Mm-hmm. I mean, not just we're going to have a little talk about it, but intense engagement, including with school groups, with other parent groups, and so forth. It's still an uphill battle. But the idea that, you know, the parents just say, well, you just go watch TV, or I'm going to go out and you can, you know, just go online, is a catastrophe.
Mm-hmm. I have an email and a phone call, and we're getting back down to closer to 15 to 16 minutes before we're done. And so I want to try to answer these. The email comes in and it asks a couple of questions. I'm going to leave one off because I don't think any of us have the answer to, but two of them are. One, the first one, does anyone put out any information in different languages, such as simple CDs, audio tapes, and brochures, so that people where English is not their first language can be able to understand better about birth control and reproduction? You guys know the answers to that question.
Speaking for Alaska, we do have a lot of documentation that's in Spanish. We've been working on getting some in Alaska native languages, but right now we have some documentation that's available in Spanish.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think that's true for us and a lot of other sites, is that there's quite a bit in Spanish, but beyond that, often not.
All right. The second question on the email, is anyone helping women who may not have been allowed to learn about reproduction, either through religious beliefs or a lack of available education? Where can more adult women who need more information go and get it?
They can certainly come into our clinic
which is
Planned Parenthood. And I do education with folks of all ages. We also do group education with parents on how to talk to your teens about sex. We do education with grandparents. We do education with anyone of any age who has a question or concern about anything that has to do with sex or sexuality.
On our website, we have a section for parents. We have found that anytime we put something out for parents, that it's always just gobbled up. I mean, the need is so great. Mm-hmm. So we have 10 tips for parents and all sorts of relationship guides and endless discussions to help parents out.
Okay.
Yeah, we see a high demand for that as well.
Okay. Well, yeah. I mean, it would go along with what you guys were saying from the beginning, is it's just not a teen issue.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Susan, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Well, I have a couple of comments. I really enjoy this program. And when you're talking about the media, I have been really struck by the very popular book Twilight and its sequels, and how much teenagers and even prepubescent kids, and as well as their mothers, are now eating this up. You know, the whole book is about desire and vampires, and it's written from a point of view of abstinence is the best policy. But, of course, the boy in the book is a vampire with superhuman strength, and I've certainly never met any teenage boy like the hero of the book. And also, in my little community, we see a lot of fundamentalists who really inherently believe that birth control is wrong, that it implies a lack of respect for women, that it increases the divorce rate, and that sex for any reason other than reproduction is lust. And I really, how do you counter these basic beliefs in a way that is going to catch people's attention and make them look at some of the educational pieces that they may be missing? Thanks.
Okay, thanks for your call, Susan. Let's ask for your comments.
Well, I think. Oh, sure. I think
yeah, no,
it's.
No,
Oh, go ahead, Sarah.
No, I think you should answer that because you know it's in your state.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a really tough decision, and the only thing that we can do is focus on the health and safety of our young people or of our citizens, regardless of their age. And if there is a group that is morally opposed to birth control, morally opposed to sex outside of reproduction, that's their belief system, and we can't really challenge that belief system. We can just speak to the need for education and the need for knowledge and awareness of the risks of having unprotected sex or early sex, and hope that those resources are available for those individuals that might be in that group, that they can access those and themselves.
Yeah, I would just add one more comment. You know, we're having a discussion here amongst three people who largely have a health orientation and a research orientation, education orientation to these issues. But the caller is absolutely right. There are a number of people who approach these issues from a very, very different perspective, having to do with deep faith, various value sets and so forth. And that is just the way it is. Sex, reproduction, family life, child rearing, male-female relations, they aren't just health issues or risk issues. They really do touch some of the deepest feelings we all have. And I think that the variety of views people have will continue. We certainly see it worldwide. They're just enormously different constructs that people bring to these issues.
Okay. Let's take another caller. Sophie, you're on line one.
Yes, hi. I was hoping that you could talk a little bit about the relationship between young women who have been either abused as children or who are victims of dating violence and the relationship between the violence and teen pregnancy. Thank you.
So that gets those men involved, yep. Doesn't it? Okay, sure. Yeah. Thanks for the call.
Well, it's a critical point. I mean, we've known for years from very good research that young women who have been abused physically or sexually in their childhood are at much greater risk of teen pregnancy. I mean, if you think about it, they've already been used and abused. And the idea of using protection or being able to say no or sort of chart one's own life path has been so severely compromised that the risk is greater. And, of course, that then, even for young women who have not had that kind of history in their childhood, violence and huge power differences always increase the risk. It's one of the reasons we often say to parents, do not let your son or daughter get romantically involved with somebody significantly older, for example, because of the power differences, even if it's not expressed in violence. Power and sex are very closely related in many instances. And I'm sure, I'm absolutely certain that Nzina will have a lot to say on this from her On the Grand experience.
Well, just adding to what you've said is, you know, exactly right. We see that women, young women who are dating measurably older men are less likely to use birth control. And it goes back to that issue of power control. They're more likely to have sex sooner. They're more likely to experience an unplanned pregnancy. And the list just goes on and on. And it is a direct correlation and a direct response. And it's something that we need to address.
We have only about 4 minutes. This has really been a very fast program, and perhaps we should make comments just briefly about the consequences and why does it matter that we talk about teen and unplanned pregnancy. Just a few headlines maybe for why that's important.
Well, a lot of teen pregnancy and a lot of unintended pregnancy results in single parenthood. And single parenthood is closely associated, of course, also with poverty, because we have only one breadwinner. And early parenthood, particularly for teens, often interrupts education, so that the earning power of the single mother is compromised as well. So the risks are economic for sure. In this tough economy, young people need the most education they can possibly get their hands on in order to have any hope of a stable job. And that applies, you know, not just to graduating from high school, but increasingly the data show you need 2, if not 4 years of education beyond that. And anything that gets in the way of educational attainment right now not only harms the young woman and the young man who often is slapped for child support enforcement, but it also means that the child is at grave economic risk, which of course then translates into poorer schools and, you know, the whole cascade. And it's also true that, particularly for unintended pregnancy, one of the consequences is abortion. The vast majority of abortions are obtained by women who become pregnant when they don't want to and are deeply and profoundly distressed by it, and they make the legal choice of abortion. And to the extent that people think that's something they'd rather see less of, and both pro-choice and pro-life people generally would like to see less abortion, the common ground here is to reduce unintended pregnancy. Mm-hmm. That is what lies behind about 95% of abortions, the remaining being people who find serious genetic defects or health problems affecting the mother, who then elect to terminate after maybe an intended pregnancy. But for all those reasons and more, we need to help women, teenagers, women, men of all ages, manage their fertility and manage their pregnancies with more success than they do now. The U.S. has the highest rates of teen pregnancy and unplanned pregnancy in the developed world. It's sort of like the frontier. I call it sometimes fertility chaos. And we need to get the simple message to our policymakers, our parents, to everybody nationwide, that getting pregnant, bearing children, and raising families are the most important thing any of us do. And it merits incredibly focused attention, the best programming, messages, services, and education we have. It's the most important thing we do.
All right. Well, I guess I need to end this. This has been a remarkably educational hour to me and enlightening to see the amount of intelligence and due diligence that the two organizations appear to be putting into this. My thanks very much to Sarah Brown, who's joined us by telephone. She's the CEO of the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unintended Pregnancy, and in the studio, and Zena Morari, who is with Planned Parenthood of the Great Northwest. Thanks again to both of you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Next week, we're going to be here again, and we'll be discussing disorders of the female genital urinary tract with Dr. Andrea Wang, who is a urogynecologist, I guess is a term that we may need to learn a little bit about next week. So we'll ask you to tune into your health and learn more next Monday, July 13th at 2 p.m. We'll be repeating the same evening at 8 p.m. as we always do on FM 91.1. For KSKA and for Line 1, this is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
This has been Line 1, your health connection. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508, or email us at line1@kska.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at kska.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.